first question we're asking everybody.
Sure.
Name, age, and what's your day job?
Name is Dan Clodfelter. Age is 65. And it depends on what day you're asking as to what the day job is. I guess my non-political job is I'm a lawyer.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you are also the current incumbent mayor of Charlotte.
That's what they tell me, yes.
So you've been in office a little over a year.
About 15 months, yeah.
So I'm curious, what are your major accomplishments to date?
Well, I think the first thing I did was what I was asked to do, which was to come in and try to calm the waters and sort of stabilize things and bring folks back to focus on what the issues were confronting the city. That took some time. It wasn't as hard as I thought it might be, but it took a little longer to convince people that the city was really in good shape than I had thought it might.
Are we there yet? Is there trust back?
I think it is. I think it is. I mean, there are areas of where we got to work on trust in the community, but they really aren't areas that are linked to what happened to my predecessor. They're really not. They don't arise out of that situation.
So you've been, again, a year and 5 months when we're taping this.
Yeah.
The nature of the job of mayor of Charlotte, it's called a weak mayor system.
That's what they say.
The official name.
Yeah, that's the official name.
I'm not going to ask you whether or not it's a weak mayor position. What I'm going to ask you is, you still happy that you jumped to the side, or is it better to be a senior leader in the minority party in the Senate?
Well, they're different things. I mean, each has its own challenges and each has its own opportunities and rewards. I've really enjoyed this. It's jumping back into something that's so very, very different from the legislative process has really been energizing. And what I've liked best is basically rediscovering the city that has just exploded over the 15 years that I was off in the General Assembly. And getting really immersed back in the city every day, 24/7, and rediscovering what a special place this is has been a lot of fun. It's a different challenge. I like the fact that I'm not responsible for hiring and firing of department heads. I like the fact that I'm not responsible for how the departments are actually run. That gives me a chance to sort of look up and look around the community and get involved in anything I want to get involved in.
And what does the mayor do from day to day?
Well, it depends on the day. An awful lot of the work is just sort of conversational work. It's interaction. It's discussion. It's planning ideas. It's debating ideas. It's seeding ground. It's meeting with folks who've got ideas and talking about, well, how can we help further this and move it along. It really is more of an idea platform than the legislature was, quite frankly.
And working with the city council, I'm fascinated. I mean, watching the mayor, it seems like a bit of a tap dance that you do all the time with the city council because you don't have a vote unless there's a tie.
It's a very diverse group of people. I think they're very talented group of people. They're very strong-willed people, and they're a very wide range of opinions. I think one of the things I've been able to do is to get the group to sort of focus more on their collective mission and their collective assignments. It's not to say we don't have disputes break out and differences of opinion that can get pretty vigorous. But one of the things I was told when I took the job was that the council was very factionalized. I think we've tried to work in a direction to sort of get them more on to view themselves as a single unit.
As you well know, the city is facing kind of a bizarre situation when it comes to financing. The city is doing better.
Indeed.
The economy is improving.
Indeed.
And the budget is shrinking.
Indeed.
So how would you, as mayor, if you are elected, how do you deal with this? Where do you want to see the city going in terms of the budget?
Well, the manager has done a really superb job of keeping things on an even keel in the challenges that we've been given. And typically the curveballs have been thrown out of Raleigh. What I think is that we get to sort of back up a little bit from the day-to-day tussles with the General Assembly and sort of invite the leaders at the state level to have a broader conversation about a new grand bargain between local governments and the state and the state government itself. The last time we had a significant analysis or examination of the allocation of responsibilities and the allocation of revenues between the state and local governments was in the 1930s. And what we're seeing now, I think what we're seeing happening is not just one-off kinds of things. I think we're seeing the stresses that have come to the surface in that system that was built 100 years ago, where the state takes responsibility for certain things, local governments take responsibility for other things. And so I think we've got to back up and say to the state, look, the state has changed. We've got major urban centers that we didn't have in the 1930s now. And one of the things we need to say is let's give us a little more flexibility. Give us a little more autonomy. Let us have a little more control over our own resources. But in exchange for that, we have to be prepared, local governments, to say to the state, and we're willing to shoulder some more responsibilities in exchange for that.
Now, let's get,
I think that's a dialogue the state would be willing to have with us.
And let's get specific. One of the tightest things here when it comes to state politics, it's not really a Republican-Democrat divide as much as it is an urban versus rural
divide.
It is. So when you're talking about a new grand bargain, what would that look like?
Well, again, I think it would take let's talk about transportation, for example. In the 1930s, the state took over from local governments almost exclusively responsibility for the roadway network. I think we're probably through that. I think we're done with that model. I think we need to be able to go to the state now and say, look, give us regional collective authority over a good portion of our transportation network and allow us to raise the revenues that we need to fund that, and we'll take responsibility for that again. That's one example of it. I think the same thing is going to happen to us with some other institutions like our community colleges, for example.
Now, one of the big things everybody's waiting to see is if the General Assembly does, in fact, redistribute sales tax from urban cores to more of a rural, everybody gets a piece, as opposed to right now how it's set up where 75% stays at the point of sale.
Right.
How do you budget for that? Is this a situation where if that passes, there's a very good chance that we could see property taxes rise in the state?
If the General Assembly does what's in the current Senate budget, the Senate version of the adopted budget, it will have an impact on us that we cannot deal with without major cuts in service or an increase in property taxes. Those are our only two choices. And again, that's why I say, Tom, what we've got to do is invite the state to have a dialogue in which there's a broader menu of things that we can do locally. And so we're not forced to that choice of either cutting back on basic services or raising property taxes. A lot of the rural communities that stand to benefit from this transfer already have lower property taxes than Charlotte. So I'm not really sure what's to be gained by all of this. One of the things I've said to some of the legislative leaders is, look, you're already getting from Mecklenburg County about $29 million a year in sales taxes generated here that's being redistributed elsewhere around the North Carolina. Has it made a difference? Has it really made a difference in the economic future of those communities? And if it hasn't, then what's to think that just dumping a little more money in there is going to change their future? It's not. We're not dealing with the correct problem.
Let's go back to transportation.
Yeah,
you brought it up just a second ago.
Yeah.
Toll roads. Toll roads are really controversial
right now.
And most people are looking at 77.
Right.
But there are other toll roads that are in the works. 74, 45 South.
That's correct. Possibly 77 South.
Your view on toll roads, is that the future?
I don't like them. But unless the state is willing to completely change the way it funds the road building program, I'm afraid we're going to have to deal with them. Right now, when I left the General Assembly, the gap between our funding sources and the projects that were on the needs list, not the wish list, but the needs list, was $66 billion. Now, that's a number that's just a massive number. There's no way to close that gap without some pretty creative thinking. Toll roads, the state has concluded, are part of that mix. I don't think we're going to see that go away completely.
Another controversial mode of transport.
Yep.
Streetcar.
Well, to some.
Have you ridden it yet?
Yeah.
What do you think?
It's fun. Well, I'll be glad when we get the new cars. They're on order. We just didn't have them for the opening of phase one, but they'll be ready for delivery in a couple of years. I think it'll be even more fun when we have it then. One of the things that's different about a streetcar, and I don't think this gets enough discussion, as compared to the light rail system. A light rail system, you're sort of moving from stop to stop. And so all of the development builds in clusters right around certain stops, and it goes up vertically. A streetcar is more street level. It fosters development at the storefront, at the pedestrian level, all along the whole route because the stops are much more frequent. They're closer together. You're never more than about a block away from any destination. So you get a different kind of a development along a streetcar. I think you get a much more pedestrian-friendly development. You get a much more sort of a urban-feeling development than you do with a commuter system like a light rail.
Now, I spoke with Edwin Peacock and Scott Stone, who are obviously not big fans of the streetcar.
So I'm told.
They both say that it's, in essence, a boondoggle. It's not going to bring the kind of economic development that city planners are hoping for. So they even say that the money is better used in other ways, doing economic development projects specifically for specific neighborhoods.
Look, we have already seen development occur in the expectation of the streetcar coming. I've seen that over the last 4 or 5 years just in the part of town I live in. A lot of the development that has gone up right along Central Avenue at Hawthorne Lane in the last 5 years is a direct consequence of the announcement that that's where the streetcar is going to go.
Hmm.
We're already seeing the same thing occur on the other side of I-77 up toward Johnson C. Smith University. There's an awful lot of land transactions going on, land assemblages going on. A lot of land is beginning to move and assemble for redevelopment. Why is that happening? Because everybody says the streetcar is coming out here. We know it's going to work. It's worked in other cities. We don't have to guess. And as I say, all you have to do is drive Hawthorne Lane and Central Avenue. Those new developments there, the residential condos and apartments that are being built there, are a direct consequence of the announcement that that's the streetcar route.
So it's already successful.
It's already successful.
Okay. Let's talk about economic incentives.
Sure.
Always controversial.
Yeah.
As mayor,
yep.
What do you think the role is of economic incentives in bringing businesses here?
Like everybody, I wish we didn't have to do them, but you're in a game where you can't do unilateral nuclear disarmament, as it were. One of the problems we've got locally with incentives is this, is we really want to incentivize job creation. We really want to incentivize job creation. But the structure of our incentive programs is based upon the extent to which a company invests in hard assets. So a company that makes an investment in a very large facility or an expensive piece of equipment will get a significant incentive even if they're employing a small number of people. And so there's a mismatch between the incentive tools that we've got to work with and what we're really trying to accomplish with those incentives, which are to create and incentivize the creation of jobs that can be filled locally. I think we got to back up and basically do a redesign. It's a good time to do that, Tom, because, of course, the state right now is in a furor and in six and sevens, about what they're going to do with state-level incentives. We cannot put enough incentives on the table locally by ourselves to make a difference to many companies. It requires working with the state on that. So since the state has got that issue on the table, it's time for us to do the same.
I want to talk a bit about the Carrick trial, which is going on right now.
Sure.
In your eyes, what is the view of the mayor, or what is the role, rather, of the mayor in helping to make sure that Charlotte is not the next Baltimore or Ferguson? How do we keep the peace? What is your role in that?
Well, I've tried to be very supportive of a lot of the initiatives that have been taken under the leadership of former Chief Monroe and Chief Putney now, who has picked up the flag and carried it forward, and a number of community groups who have partnered with the police department to try to sort of build community understanding, to create forums for community dialogue in which people can talk about their issues, not after they get an announcement on the 6 o'clock news about a verdict or a shooting or a charge or a trial, but talk in advance to sort of find each other, hear each other, and listen to each other before temperatures start to rise. I think we've been largely successful at that. We've been as successful as it's possible to be without really knowing what happens at the end of the day. But we made the effort, and we made it in advance of a crisis actually occurring. I have to I can't say enough about the leadership of Chief Monroe and Chief Putney in that regard. And so my job as Monroe is as a mayor has been to be a cheerleader, an advocate, a supporter. I've helped him raise a little bit of money for the Cops and Barbers program. I've gone out and tapped some community resources to help fund that Cops and Barbers dialogue program. I think that's the kind of thing the mayor has to do.
What about the leadership of another key city official, Ron
sure.
Carley?
Yeah.
What is your view of his job so far?
I think in difficult circumstances, he's done a good job. He plunged right in. Almost the first thing that hit him in the face when he got here was the legislative effort to take the airport away from the city. And to walk into that, and then his mayor immediately gets appointed to the Department of Transportation, so he loses his mayor, and he's suddenly in a new community with a raging issue and without a strong sort of local leader to sort of help guide him. It was a very difficult first year on the job, as it were. I think he's done a very credible job. He's a very strategic thinker. This year on the budget, for example, when we were hit with the loss of the privileged license tax and no replacement. I mean, I think that was a terrible tax, but I'd always advocated for a replacement and always had proposed in the legislature a way to replace the tax. He didn't have that option. He had to fill the hole in the existing budget. I think he did it in a very responsible way, and it took a lot of hard work on his part.
I want to talk about a place where Charlotte and Mecklenburg County are ranking at the bottom.
Yeah.
Upward mobility.
Yeah.
You saw those reports?
I've read the reports. I have not only seen the reports, I've read the reports. Yes, sir.
What do we do? How do we address that? How would you as mayor address that in the next term?
One thing we have done, and I'll give a shout out to my colleague, Trevor Fuller, chairman of the county commission, because he's been deeply involved in this too. But early on, after the reports were released, we started talking about this as a community challenge. This is the kind of thing that historically Charlotte has always said, we've got to pick this up. We got to do something with this. What we did with our school situation in the 70s, it's the kind of thing that this community says, we're just not going to push that under the rug and forget about it and leave it up on the shelf. So we spent the last year working together to put together the Economic Opportunity Task Force, which was announced just about 2 or 3 months ago, raising funds for that from private philanthropy, securing consultants. We've got Robert Putnam from Harvard University, the author of the Bowling Alone article. He's consulting with us on the task force, putting together a very carefully crafted group of citizens in the community who have firsthand experience on what economic mobility looks like, what helps, what are the roadblocks, what are the obstacles that we overcome. It's not a typical blue ribbon leaders of the community type of study group. They've been at work now for about 2 or 3 months. And what we've charged them with is to say, we don't want you to come back and tell us that the solution here is for the federal government to do this or for the state government to do that. We want you to come back and tell us what we can do locally, concretely, to try to move the needle. We may not be able to solve all the problem without Washington's help or Raleigh's help, but tell us what we can do locally. They're to report to us next year. I've been actively engaged with the task force and the work of the task force. I hope to continue. It's one of the most important things I think we're doing right now.
I'm going to ask you to put on your headphones.
Yeah, okay, sure.
And I'm going to have you we'll have you do your elevator pitch here in a moment, but can you still hear me okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I'm going to have to turn off the mic here in just a second because if I play the tape with the mics on, we both lose our hearing permanently. You came in under very difficult circumstances for the city. We've talked about that. Patrick Cannon eventually ends up in federal penitentiary. You were appointed his replacement. You and I spoke, actually. I had the pleasure of talking to you in the office when you first came in. And I'm going to play for you a cut of tape. Because, and you know where I'm going with this, because there are certain members of the council that are still a little upset at this. So let me start with the tape. So take a listen.
Okay.
There are a number of sitting council members that reportedly are interested in seeking the mayor's office in 2015. Did you ever promise to not run, or were you ever asked not to run?
Some of them asked me, not all of them, but some of them said, would you not run in 2015? I said, look, I don't have any plans to run in 2015. I also said to them, though, I said, you know, if we get down the road and you guys think this is working out pretty cool, and I like it too, I would look at a little more, but not much.
So at that point, you said you had no plans to run.
That was true at the time.
What changed?
I got into the job. I discovered that I liked the job. I discovered that actually I think I was pretty good at the job and sort of felt like there were some things I just didn't want to walk away from and leave undone. It wasn't a job that I was seeking. It happened. It wasn't a job that I had on my bucket list or my checklist. And so at that time, I really wasn't sure whether I would really even want to do the job again or much less be any good at the job. So I was clear at the time. I said, I don't have any plans. I didn't. Some were saying to me, don't commit not to run. Others were saying, we want you not to run. There never was a clear consensus on council about what they did and didn't want. So I tried to tell them, though, let's give it a year and I might change my mind.
Well, there has been a history of people in your position who have stepped forward to fill in as, you know, an appointed mayor who have not run. In fact, the last two people in your position did not run for mayor. And you said, though, that you would reach out to council members and see what they thought, whether or not and, you know, they thought you were doing a good job. I think you said if everything's cool.
Yep.
Did you do that?
I talked with them. I got some good reactions. Not, again, universal. It's a group of 11 people with a lot of different opinions. But I got some encouragement, and I got a lot of community encouragement. I got an awful lot of community encouragement. And I thought, well, let's let voters see what they want to do. Let's let them make a choice. I wasn't ready to walk away and leave the work undone.
There are a number of members on council, though, who don't like that decision. And you're just shaking your head, and that's
well,
okay.
I'm saying that now is a decision that's in the hands of the voters.
Let's end on a positive note.
Sure.
Actually, we can take our headphones off.
Okay.
Thank you. We're ending all of these with a simple question.
Yeah.
What is your elevator pitch to the voters out there as to why they should vote for Dan Clodfelter for mayor?
I think I bring a combination of pragmatism, level-headedness, a proven effectiveness, and a clear eye about what the issues are facing Charlotte, and some understanding of what we can do to address those issues. I think I'm the candidate with the best package on all of those.
Dan Clodfelter, thank you much.
Yeah.